And I'm Phil Lantzman. Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Good to have you. Our weekly mission is to keep South Florida informed on local and regional news and issues affecting our community with a panel of the area's top journalists. And this week they are as follows. She is the editorial page editor for the South Florida Sun-Sentinel, which this week won its first Pulitzer Prize for its investigation into speeding cops in our area. And that is Rosemary Goudreau. Welcome back, Rosemary. Good to have you. Congratulations.
Thanks, thank you, Phil. Happy to be here.
A contributor to Time Magazine, an award-winning journalist in his own right, who's been here for a very long time, covering South Florida. He's covered, our entire hemisphere at some point. And that is Tim Padgett. We love having you on back to the show as well, Tim.
And I love being here. Thanks, Phil.
And joining us from Tallahassee is another veteran of the Florida News Wars. He is the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Tampa Bay Times, Steve Bosque. Hey, Steve, welcome back to you.
Hi, Phil. Thanks for having me.
And
good to be here.
I want to remind you that if there's any significant developments from Boston, we will not hesitate to go back to NPR for coverage of the situation there. And they've done a wonderful job all day. And if something warrants, we'll go back to them. But we do have an online discussion that's taking place on our website, WLRN.org, where our shows are posted in their entirety. We can also be found on Facebook at the Florida Roundup and followed on Twitter at WLRN. So getting the big elephant out of the room first here with the Boston Marathon bombings, you know, we have a tendency to wonder, at least I did when this happened, could this type of event happen here? And I think every community probably asked that question this week when they heard about this. Tim, do you think about that too?
Oh, of course. And I think we've already had indications in the recent past in the city that this sort of thing could happen. All you have to do is point to knucklehead groups like the Liberty City Seven, who, although they fortunately were not able to carry out whatever plan they might have had, they were sort of an example of how easy it might be to radicalize people that we may not, you know, have on our radar screen at all. Jose Padilla, a decade ago, the so-called dirty bomber, was another example of how easy, again, it can be to radicalize, especially younger people like these two brothers up in Boston.
And, you know, every time something significant happens around the world, it always seems that there's a significant amount of people from the region. If this turns out, this the Republic of Chechnya, the Russian Republic, a lot of Russians in South Florida. I don't know if there's a storyline there, you know, obviously there's always a local connection. You always try to find those things. Rosemary, from your perspective, how does this resonate here?
Well, I agree with Tim that this is something that can happen anywhere, and we've seen tragedies. Too many tragedies in recent years. This one happens to be a bomb, but how many have we seen with guns and schools and movie theaters and the Oklahoma City? And so I guess the message is that bad things happen and that we just have to be vigilant, and our law enforcement has to, you know, keep up on things. And one of the remarkable things to me about this is how quickly they have identified and are narrowing in on these guys. Part of the lesson, I think, is all these cameras that are on all these buildings. And so when you're in public, know that somebody's watching you. And in this case, while we might have some concerns about Big Brother always watching us, in this case, it appears to be helping us catch the bad guys quickly.
Steve Bosque in Tallahassee, what's the view from the Capitol?
Well, Phil, I would say this, you know, the possibility that Florida could be a target or be involved in one of these things is certainly nothing new, because I think back to the 9/11 terrorists who hijacked those airplanes. And remember all the Florida connections, you know, Mohammed Atta getting a Florida driver's license and once getting stopped by a Broward sheriff's deputy not long before the attacks. The fact that they took flight lessons in Venice. Remember that story?
Mm-hmm.
So,
still the,
you know,
Sarasota connection, too, which has been reported on this week. Updates on that.
Right, absolutely. So, you know, I thought that President Obama's statements about Boston and the unique, iconic nature of that city and that part of the country. I was born and raised in New England myself. I've covered Boston marathons. I thought his comments were very strong and reassuring. And I agree with the point Rosemary made, which is that, you know, it looked like authorities had very little to go on here. Two guys with backpacks, one with a black cap, one with a white cap, at an event, you know, attended by probably 500,000 people. And yet they appear to have found these two guys pretty quickly.
And, Tim, you were actually one of the half – you and your son were
I was
there,
in Massachusetts
right?
earlier this week, and I was actually in Boston visiting colleges with my son the day after the bombings. And what struck me was, A, how quickly things had returned to normal, which showed me that they weren't making the mistake of overreacting to this. But by the same time, you could tell how determined the city was to get to the bottom of this, which they did. And I think that's how they've responded this week should be a model for any city when and if you do encounter this kind of situation in the future.
And you're listening to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman. That's Tim Padgett, contributor to Time Magazine. We also have Rosemary Goudreau, who's the editorial page editor for the South Florida Sun Sentinel, and Steve Bosquet from the Tampa Bay Times, who also won a Pulitzer Prize this week. We'll get into a little bit of that later on. A lot of stuff going on in the world, and especially in Washington, which is being felt here in South Florida, the failure of the gun legislation in the U.S. Senate, Democrats reacting angrily to the U.S. Senate's rejection of the bipartisan plan endorsed by President Obama that would broaden background checks for gun buyers. But in the Republican-controlled Florida legislature, the reaction was that of celebration when the bill failed in the Senate on Wednesday. Here is a portion of a piece that was filed by WLRN's Rick Stone in Tallahassee.
Word reached the House chamber. The compromise gun bill, the one for the Newtown families, had failed in the Senate,
which now makes gun control dead.
Applause erupted. Most of the Republican members were jubilant.
And let's let liberty ring!
All right, so that's a piece of a story that Rick Stone filed us from our Tallahassee Bureau. Steve Bosquet, what did you observe?
Well, nothing new here. There's a strong support for the Second Amendment in the Florida legislature. There's widespread opposition to any new gun control regulations of any kind. And I want to put it in historical perspective and dissuade your listeners from thinking this is purely a Republican phenomenon, although the Republican majority in Tallahassee has been extremely pro-gun. You know, the NRA has been represented by the very tenacious Marion Hammer for a long time. Mm-hmm. But in a piece I wrote before the session started, the definitive gun control vote in Florida took place in 1987 when Democrats controlled both houses. And what they did was they passed what's known as a preemption bill. They basically said that with few exceptions, cities and counties can't pass tough gun control laws. That authority is reserved only to the Florida legislature. Why would the NRA want that? Because the NRA would much rather deal with 160 politicians in Tallahassee and influence them than to have to deal piecemeal with 67 counties and hundreds of cities around the state. At the time, you had places like Broward County trying to impose really strict handgun control laws that the NRA didn't like. So Democrats ran the show back then, and as a result of that preemption vote in 1987, the NRA has pretty much gotten what they've wanted from the Florida legislature.
And Rosemary, I would suspect that the reaction is much different here in South Florida than it was that we just heard in Tallahassee.
Letters to the editor of the Sun Sentinel, overwhelmingly shame, shame, shame on Congress. More than 90%, some of the polls showed 90% of the people wanted background checks.
In Florida.
And these were... And this was background check that had a loophole the size of a Mack truck. I mean, it said that you have to do a background check if you buy a gun in a shop or at a gun show, but it exempted if you sold it to a friend. Now, how do we define a friend? You know, it's a pretty broad definition. And even with a loophole that big, they couldn't pass it.
And I spoke this week with... Broward-based Democrat Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, also chairwoman of the Democratic National Committee. She told me she believes there will be political consequences for Republicans who shot down the legislation.
You know, I think there will be electoral consequences to individuals who decide that supporting gun manufacturers and arms dealers is more important than making sure that we protect our families and kids in schools.
And, in fact, she cited the same poll that you just did, the Quinnipiac poll. I looked it up, a recent poll that shows, I think, 10 of 11 Floridians favored the extended background checks. You think, Tim, that Floridians have become more gun intolerant since Newtown?
Well, I think emotionally,
notwithstanding the legislature.
Right. Emotionally, perhaps, but you know, we keep pointing to that 90%, but the sad reality, at least if you're a gun control advocate, is that 90% is politically anemic, really, still, compared to lobby groups like the NRA. And I think it's also, you know, it's a sector of the population, the political population, that has felt so beaten down constantly over the decades by lobby groups like the NRA, that it's going to take a long time to see it develop the kind of potency that the gun rights lobby has.
Hey, Phil.
Yeah, go ahead, Steve.
Very quickly, as to Debbie Wasserman Schultz's point about electoral consequences, I've got Exhibit A to put on the radar screen for everyone. Here it is. There's a Republican congressman in North Florida, a Tea Party favorite, who is strongly pro-gun. His name is Steve Sutherland. He's running for re-election, and he has a serious opponent in Gwen Graham, the oldest daughter of former Senator Bob Graham's daughter, former Senator, former Governor Bob Graham, who undoubtedly is in favor of stricter gun controls and for background checks. Now, the district, stretches across the panhandle, but it's anchored, frankly, by Leon County, by Tallahassee, which is one of the most liberal pockets in North Florida. And undoubtedly, this is going to be an issue in that campaign.
Now, that's a great setup for what's to come. We have plenty more as far as national stuff to talk about. And one more major thing, and that's the immigration proposal. I'm going to table that for after our break. And then when we get back, we'll also delve into Venezuela. Tim Padgett has done a tremendous amount of reporting on that as well. Lots of stuff to get to, so we'll take the early break. You're listening to the Florida Roundup. I'm Phil Latzman, back with our panel and more in just a moment. We welcome you back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I want to remind you that we do have an online discussion as well taking place on our website by our social media editor, Danny Rivero. It's at WLRN.org. And you can always connect with us via social network. We have a Facebook page. You can like us there. We post the shows there. And I know all of us are also on Twitter. Every good journalist is. Tim, you want to give your Twitter address out for those?
TimPadgett2.
Tim Padgett 2. So there was a 1 there someplace, but you have the number 2, so make sure. And it's PADGETT.
And to my daughter, I didn't make the mistake of saying at first.
Rosemary, what's yours?
And I'm Rosemary Goodrow. Rosemary's one word with a Y, Goodrow, G-O-U-D-R-E-A.
Oh, I think maybe. Did I spell it right? I hope I did. Anyway, people can't spell mine either, but Steve Bosquet, you have some issues with your name, so you should spell out your Twitter handle.
Sure, it's all one word. It's Steve Bosquet, and that's BOUSQUET.
And I'm PHIL.
Just the way it sounds.
Yeah, just exactly. I'm PHILLATZMAN on Twitter. We all love to interact with you there, and again on our live blog. So we're going to get to Venezuela in just a moment, but sort of related, the immigration issues. Florida's freshman senator was a major part of the news cycle this week. As a member of the Senate's Gang of Eight, he has been the front man for the immigration reform proposal, finally released in the middle of all the other chaos that happened this week. It's an 844-page bill, the core provision being a path to citizenship for immigrants in the country illegally.
It is not good for this country to have millions of people living in shadows. And number two, we're dealing with this issue because this is who we are. We are the most compassionate nation on earth. It's tragic that a nation of immigrants remains divided on the issue of immigration. This must once again become our strength.
And I was listening, driving home yesterday to Rush Limbaugh, and there was Marco Rubio. He's been on all the conservative talk shows right now trying to make his case. Now he's hearing it from both sides about this immigration proposal. Tim Padgett, what do you see there?
Well, I see Marco Rubio in a tough spot right now. We were just discussing gun control, and he did not support gun control, despite the fact that 90% of his state's population was for it. And I think that's...
He didn't read the entire bill either.
Exactly. But I think, again, that's an object lesson in how politicians think to a certain degree, because if you're a Republican like Rubio and you're telling your Tea Party base, let's face it, I'm going to support immigration reform, which they can't stand, you have to throw them a bone. And I think a lot of Republicans in the Senate may have been thinking the same way. We've got to get immigration reform because we need to get Hispanic voters back, but we won't support gun control as a way of sort of placating our angry Tea Party base.
And he's been a bit of a pickle. Advocates for undocumented worry that the bill makes the path of citizenship too onerous. And then the Tea Party activists have been now protesting it at Marco Rubio's offices. And Steve Bosquet, having covered him in Tallahassee, this is a bit of a predicament that he finds himself in, maybe the worst one of his term in the Senate so far.
It is. I think the guy deserves credit for trying to forge some sort of solution here. But you know, this country has not resolved this issue now for decades. You've seen, for example, Governor Rick Scott back way away from this issue. He hasn't talked about immigration in months. You know, the economy of the state is slowly but steadily improving. And it seems that the attitude people have, the hostility toward undocumented folks being in Florida, dissipates as the economy improves because people are not quite as economically insecure. So, you know, this is going to be a signature issue for Marco Rubio going forward, undoubtedly.
And the bill could put 11 million undocumented on a path to citizenship, an estimated 740,000 of them here in the state of Florida, Rosemary.
Yes, as disappointed as I am with Marco Rubio for his position on the gun bill, not even wanting it allow it to come up for debate, good for him for having the courage to help lead the way on immigration reform. Remember, former Senator Mel Martinez of Florida tried to be a leader on immigration during his term in the Senate.
It didn't help him.
And it meant that he had to leave the Senate because he lost his base on this. The Tea Party is politicians are really afraid of that Tea Party group because they have the time to get out and protest, and they make a lot of noise, and they look a lot bigger than they are. So, hey, applause to Marco. And for those who think 13 years is too long, I would say, hey, get the first step. Get some movement on here. At least it's an opening. It's an open door, and it's a first step on which more improvements can be made.
Yeah, and Phil, I would add one thing that we've been so focused on the citizenship path and how long that would take. I would suggest that the thing we really need to be watching as this thing gets amended and revised in the next few weeks is the path, how long it takes the path to legal residency. That's what, to me, is really important. How do we get these people, not as citizens, but settled in legally so that they become more productive members of our society?
And speaking of legal residents, plenty of them from Venezuela here in South Florida watching very closely at what's going on in their home country. And it seems like a long time ago now that Venezuelans went to the polls on Sunday to pick a new president to replace the late Hugo Chavez. And the vote was a lot closer than anyone expected. This, in fact, is the sound of pots and pans being banged in the streets of Caracas by supporters of opposition candidate Enrique Capriles, who lost the election by just about 270,000 votes and claims widespread fraud on the part of the Chavismo, who supported establishment candidate Nicolas Maduro. The close elections have sparked widespread protests, deadly violence in Venezuela, and of course we have close ties with the tens of thousands of expatriates here. So, Tim Padgett, you have covered this story extensively for Time Magazine. You called it an embarrassingly tight margin, and in your story for Time this week, you argue that even if Maduro won, he lost.
Well, you just played that tape of the pots and pans, which in Venezuela is known as cacerolazo. And what's ironic about that is the fact that it was that noise of the cacerolazos 20 years ago that brought Hugo Chavez after he failed in a coup attempt, which everyone, especially the poor in Venezuela, seemed to support by beating pots and pans. Now you've got the opposition in Venezuela doing the same thing, and it's a real telling reversal. It's what it indicates is that with Chavez gone after his death, with his sort of demagogic demigod presence gone, Venezuelans are seeing what a raft of social and economic messes he left behind. And unfortunately for the Chavistas, he didn't really groom anybody to adequately fill his red beret. And there is no real political figure there who can make them forget about those messes the way Chavez could.
And the guy that he was counting on was Nicolas Maduro, who did not turn out to be the magnanimous candidate that Chavez or the rest of the Chavismo thought. But here's part of his victory speech on Sunday night.
Los que transmiten las informaciones formales en el caso venezolano, constitucional, ilegal es el poder electoral. Aquí está
And there it is, he said, and then he called the elections constitutional and legal. But as we've said, there's some developments that are just even fresh today.
Well, he realizes that because this was, as I said in my article, such an embarrassingly tight margin for him. I mean, you have to remember, just 6 months ago, Hugo Chavez beat Enrique Capriles by 11 points. And Nicolas Maduro, couldn't really eke out a statistically convincing victory. So he has to allow a recount of these votes just to convince people that he's not trying to be an authoritarian dictator, which is a big fear. And, what this election was really about was whether Chavismo can survive without Chavez. And that's why I said in my article, even though Nicolas Maduro won, he lost on that more important score.
In equal time, we'll hear from Enrique Capriles, who never made his concession speech. He says the council now, the electoral count, says it will audit the 46% of the vote not scrutinized. And on late Sunday night, he said there were thousands of examples of fraud.
Diciéndole a nuestra Venezuela, a nuestro pueblo, yo no pacto ni con la mentira ni con la corrupción. Mi pacto es con Dios y con los venezolanos.
So I'm not sure he was accusing the other side of lies and corruption in that particular statement, but that's what seems to be the mantra right now.
Yeah, and what you've got now is Nicolas Maduro and the Chavistas sort of humiliated backs up against a wall. And what's going to be very important in these next few weeks is just how heavy-handed they respond to the opposition pushing against this idea that there may have been fraud, that their man Capriles was really the bona fide elected president.
All right. Well, we asked for members of the Public Insight Network to weigh on this, and we're going to get back to some state issues. But obviously, Venezuela, a very important part of our community, the Venezuelan Americans here, and we've had lots of coverage from Doral. And Rosemary, just to throw in a little bit, Weston is a huge center for Venezuelan Americans. Tell us a little bit about how the news was received there, and a lot of people disappointed.
Oh, amazing disappointment. I think for people who haven't watched Venezuela as close as Tim, there was a question when Capriles ran against Chavez and Chavez won. It's like, wow, how could Hugo Chavez win? You know, the elections must be corrupt down there. I mean, don't the people there know about this guy and through the lens through which we see him? And yet Capriles did not at that time say there was fraud. So we just went through an election with him where he accepted the results and said, okay, Chavez won. And so now this time, with it being as close to hear him call out the instances that he's saying, he has credibility because he didn't ring the bell, cry wolf last time.
And Steve, I know this is not in your bailiwick up there in Tallahassee, but it was interesting when I looked at the numbers. It was 50.7% to 49.1%. I think I looked at President Obama got about 50.8%. I think if I'm not mistaken in the election, but won by 3 percentage points because there were a lot of third party candidates. But sort of an interesting comparison there. No.
Sure. Something that sadly many Floridians can identify with, which is an unusually tight election, demands for a recount, allegations of fraud. An election like this, leaves the winner without any mandate and leaves the loser feeling as though the election was stolen.
All right. Let's hear from some of our folks here in South Florida. Many of them, I assume, are Venezuelan American. And we'll begin with Christina. Christina is in Miami. Welcome to the Florida Roundup. I know you're a bit disappointed.
Yes, definitely. I traveled to New Orleans twice to vote, the first time in October, and this was the second time I was able to fly with one of the organizations that has been sponsoring trips for us to go vote. And it has been very, very disappointing. You see a lot of people putting all their faith in the election, and it's a shame that the CNE, the Consejo Nacional Electoral, is taking the elections from us. You can see all the powers and all the institutions aligning with the state.
All right, well, thanks very much for your call. Anything you wanted to ask her, Tim?
Well, as disappointed as the opposition might feel at this moment, I think they, in the long term, they have to feel very encouraged.
All right, let's move on to Yale, who is in Miami. We welcome you to the Florida Roundup. Hi, Yale.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you? I guess, are you another disappointed Venezuelan?
Yes, but as you were saying, I'm also encouraged. I mean, it's the first time that the opposition has called out what's going on by the government and by the Electoral Council, so I think that's a big step moving forward. Never in the 14 years that Chavez had been in power, the opposition had any chance or any evidence in calling out the fraud that was going on.
And you also say that perhaps when all these votes from abroad are counted, that it might even be closer and perhaps make up the margin?
I don't think that they will make up the margin, but they'll certainly close it. And I just think that the problem's not that Capriles didn't have enough votes. I think that the problem's what he was announcing, that there are just more people, more votes than people that were registered to vote, and dead people voting and stuff like that that just is not supposed to happen. And if those irregularities are taken into account, then certainly he will have the votes that he would need to win.
Well, thanks, Yael. I appreciate your call. And one more we'll take from Miguel, who is from Miami, who's a journalist in his own right, I understand. Miguel, welcome to the Florida Roundup.
Yes. Hi, how are you?
Good.
Yes, I'm a recovering journalist.
recovering journalist, yes.
I'm also an American born in Colombia. My wife is Venezuelan. And we do travel quite a lot, the country. The way I see it, it's if Maduro is Chavez's son, Diosdado Cabello is Chavez's heart and soul, and he has his course to settle with Enrique Capriles.
Mm-hmm.
The election, although it was close, I think it gave the opposition the opportunity to really play a part in what's going to be the future of the country. Hopefully, their rhetoric, the inflamed rhetoric, will calm down, and the media will report evenly from both sides.
Tim Patrick. Tim respond.
He brings up an excellent point that we have to remember, that not only does Nicolas Maduro have to worry about an emboldened opposition now in Venezuela, he's got to worry about an emboldened opposition within his own party, the United Socialist Party. And he mentions very aptly Diosdado Cabello, the head of the National Assembly in Venezuela, who has much closer ties to the military and to the business sector in Venezuela, and has already been sending warnings this week that the party is very disappointed with Maduro's showing in this election, and that Maduro should probably be bracing himself for challenges from Cabello and others within inside Chavismo. That's going to weaken the Chavistas, and it's going to help the opposition then win, for example, more National Assembly seats and things like that in the next few years. So that's why I was saying earlier that they, in the long run, they really should be encouraged.
Thanks very much, Miguel, for your call. One final thing on this note, at least, that we just found out, a very interesting story coming out of Haiti, that Haiti is going to actually name its renovated international airport in Cape Haitien, which is the second largest city, after Hugo Chavez. Prime Minister Laurent Lamont confirmed via Twitter yesterday. Tim, give us some background as to why that happened.
Well,
it's kind of a surprise.
This is an example of Chavez ironically behaving like a capitalist. If you're a corporation and you pay the most money, you get the stadium named after you. And this is essentially what Chavez had done with the airport in Cape Haitien. I mean, he essentially paid for it. The Haitians are very grateful for it. And I think them naming the airport after him is something that I really don't think the world needs to get too worked up about.
But it certainly doesn't sound like something the U.S. government would like to hear.
Well, the U.S. government has got an industrial park very near there that it paid, you know, or didn't pay for, but helped fund quite a bit. And it probably doesn't like the idea of the Cape Haitien airport so close to that project.
They're going to call it the Barack Obama, the facility or whatever they're going to call it. I mean, whatever. I mean, it's just interesting. By the way, and as you mentioned, Haitian officials say that it happens because Venezuela contributed more than $1 billion to assist the country and a new runway for the airport. So, I see. It's a very interesting analogy, though, with naming rights. I like that.
Yeah, no, that airport and the U.S. Industrial Park right next to each other, that's what makes the Western Hemisphere fun.
Never a dull moment. All right, Tallahassee is also so much fun. When we come back, we're going to talk about stuff going on in the Capitol with our man there, Steve Bosquet, the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Tampa Bay Times. Some good news on unemployment. You're not going to believe what Broward's unemployment rate is. Really low. We'll talk about state issues, Medicaid expansion, and the rest of the week's news. You're listening to Florida Roundup. Phil Latzman, Tim Padgett, Rosemary Goudreau, and Steve Bosquet. We're back in just a moment. I And we welcome you back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Phil Latzman, reintroducing our panel formally. Rosemary Goudreau is editorial board editor for the South Florida Sun Sentinel, the Pulitzer-winning South Florida Sun Sentinel. We'll talk about that in just a few moments. Also, a winner of a Pulitzer was the Tampa Bay Times this week, and Steve Bosquez, the Tampa Bay Times Tallahassee Bureau Chief, and he's with us from the state capitol. Tim Padgett is an award-winning and amazing journalist who joins us here on the Florida Roundup every once in a while and has a very hemispheric look at things, and he is also with us, a contributor from Time Magazine. I'm Phil Latzman. Again, online discussion taking place on our website, manned by our social media editor. It's at WLRN.org. And we also post our shows in their entirety at WLRN.org. We also do that on our Facebook page, the Florida Roundup on WLRN. And we can be followed on Twitter at WLRN. Let's talk about some state stuff first. And this is some good news. Florida's unemployment rate dipped to 7.5% in March, down from a revised February rate of 7.8%. It's the lowest point since October of 2008. And just looking at this through a political lens, Steve Bosquez, is that good news for Governor Rick Scott?
Well, it would be. It should be. But at least so far, it hasn't translated. It's an amazing thing about Rick Scott, the governor of this state. The unemployment rate continues to drop, and his popularity remains very low. He's one of the least popular governors in the United States. His job approval rating is not very good, even with Republicans. You know, in these trial heats, there hasn't been one for the last 4 to 6 weeks, but these trial heat hypothetical matchups, either Charlie Crist or Alex Sink would beat Rick Scott if the election were held today. As the economy improves, it's just not helping Rick Scott, not yet anyway.
And the economy is improving. Now, here in South Florida, Broward was down to 5.7%. That's down a half point month to month. And I think it's down a full percent since the beginning of the year. Miami-Dade down 0.3%, still significantly higher, though, at 9.2%. Palm Beach is down a month-to-month by 0.6%. It's now at 6.9%. Now, I looked at that Broward number, Rosemary, and we haven't had a chance to analyze this or do any reporting on this, but 5.7% seems awfully low for Broward County.
And, you know, when you put your finger in the wind and talk to business people, and we had an event last night, the Excalibur Awards, where that brings business people together, you do hear that things are better. They still feel tenuous, but they're seeing that things are looking up. What we don't hear as much about, though, are those people who have just given up, who have dropped out of the market, out of the job market. And as Steve's point about the governor, I would say that the governor is trying to get his message out. Right now, he's on a road show where he's visiting newspaper editorial boards, and he's spent some time with us this week. And he wants to talk about the numbers. But there are so many other things that are going on that we want to talk about that it's going in the right direction. And of course, does the president get any credit for this? Well, let's not talk about who gets credit. But he has a hard time telling his story in a way that resonates with people.
And one of those things that is going on is this the issue over health insurance and Medicaid expansion in Tallahassee. Doctors, nurses, and other healthcare workers from Miami's Jackson Memorial Hospital rallied at the Capitol for Medicaid expansion yesterday. Say Floridians with health insurance now pay more for their premiums due to the cost of emergency room care for those without coverage. Here's nurse Denise Glass, who said that when uninsured patients finally go to the ER, their conditions are often far worse because they waited.
Sometimes we just need a little hand just to get us over the humps. And many times we can get these people over the humps. They don't have to die waiting.
And of course, Steve, Governor Scott says he will accept the Medicaid money, the $51 billion, but his powers of persuasiveness have not worked, especially in the House of Representatives. The Senate is considering a plan that would use the money, but the House still reluctant. What is the latest with Medicaid expansion?
Yes. If Rick Scott's been using his powers of persuasion, he hasn't been using them enough. That's the complaint that people have, is that he took a risky move politically for him. He came out in favor of Medicaid expansion. Of course, the conservative wing of his party was appalled by this, about a Rick Scott, a Tea Party favorite, embracing what people saw as a massive government entitlement program. What's happening with Medicaid expansion, Phil and panel, goes to the heart of the Florida legislature. The problem is in the House, and only in the House, where the young Speaker Will Weatherford and a cadre of his top lieutenants are adamantly opposed to taking this federal money. Just before I came to the studio, I was watching this debate playing out again and hearing Republican members describe Medicaid as a, quote, highway of dependency, unquote. The Senate would be willing to go along with Medicaid expansion, but in Florida, House members, Republicans, are elected from very small districts, from very small pools of voters, and the fear they have every 2 years as House members is being challenged from the right. That's the problem. That's the issue. And so I don't see any way around this situation that would result in Florida accepting the federal Medicaid money as long as Will Weatherford is in the Speaker's office.
Now, meanwhile, we have a House plan which should covers about 115,000 people, which is about a tenth of what should be covered with Medicaid expansion. It's not Medicaid expansion, but there's these hybrid plans they're talking about. It sounds like, Steve, they're going to probably need an extra session to figure this out, a special session to figure out how all this works because there's only 2 weeks left.
It's possible, but just a day or two ago, the Senate President Don Gates said no. You know, one thing that people are worried about is that the Senate could capitulate to the House here and that, in effect, the House would win and we'd have this plan you just described, this Richard Corcoran, who's another one of Weatherford's top advisors. He's from Pasco County, which is a plan that covers so few people as to be fairly meaningless in terms of reaching the huge pool of, you know, more than a million people in the state who need insurance. So, you know, Rick Scott has taken a tough position here for a conservative Republican, but he really hasn't tried to strong-arm the legislature because it's not in the guy's nature. It's not his style. It's not his approach. If this were Jeb Bush, if Jeb Bush felt passionately about expanding Medicaid, everybody in the country, everybody in the state would know it because he would be on the phone. He'd be twisting arms morning, noon, and night. Rick Scott's not that kind of guy.
And Rosemary, that backdrop of what's going on in Tallahassee has been all these protests from a lot of people from South Florida, the Jackson folks up there protesting, hoping that the legislature will come around, take the Medicaid expansion, but that isn't happening. But how do you see all this playing out?
Well, I just am reflecting on the clip you played of Marco Rubio talking in terms of immigration about this being the most compassionate nation on earth and what's happened to us. And we have 4 million uninsured people in Florida who cannot get access to health care. So their cancers aren't getting diagnosed, their lives are being cut short, and we're going to turn away $51 billion in federal funds over 10 years that would give access to health care, that would help our hospitals pay for these people who we're all paying for it now with the price of our premiums. But I agree with Steve, you know, that the governor did make his statement about it. He did say we should take it for the 3 years that it's 100%. But no, after that, he has kind of left it to the House and the Senate to duke it out.
Tim?
Yeah, no,
right.
Steve's point is spot on, because if you did have effective gubernatorial leadership in Tallahassee right now, I think we would be seeing a crafting of a compromise that we did have early on, if I'm not mistaken, Steve, in which you would have been using the federal money, but not via Medicaid. So we would have come up with something, fashioning something that would have been a good political compromise that both sides could have lived with, but without, as Steve points out, an effective governor to forge that, it's not going to happen.
You're listening to
right.
The Florida Roundup here on WLRN. That's Steve Bosquet with the Tampa Bay Times, just to reset things. That's Tim Padgett, you just heard from Time Magazine, contributed with Time, and South Florida Sun Sentinel editorial page editor Rosemary Goudreau. A couple other things statewide we want to get to, but Steve, you want to just wrap things up on this?
Well, just a quick point, and I want to mention a story that was in my sister paper, the Miami Herald, this week, and others have reported it too, which is, first of all, on Medicaid expansion. Remember now, all the people sitting around the table in Tallahassee making the major decisions, they're all Republicans. They're all of one party. And number two, Hispanics. Public opinion polling shows that Hispanics strongly support Medicaid expansion. Hello, Hispanics are the voters that the Republicans had such a problem with and that Mitt Romney had so many problems with in 2012. And so if you want to look at this from a purely crass political standpoint in terms of gaining an edge with a core constituency, that should suggest they'd want to do Medicaid expansion, but so far, no.
All right. One other thing, a couple other things, that the texting ban has been passed unanimously by the Senate, texting while driving. We've covered this extensively, but it is the first time it will be heard in the House. Seem to think things will be different. I guess it's 4 years that this has happened now where the House is under new leadership. Will the texting while driving secondary offense ban, we should mention, get passed?
Well, yeah, it's going to pass, but the fact that it's a secondary offense doesn't mean much. What that means, of course, is a police officer has to have another reason to stop you to cite you for texting. We're way behind most other states in dealing with this issue. It's a good example, an illustration of something that defines the Florida legislature historically. There's a strong libertarian streak here, and that is that legislators, even quite a few Democrats, it would surprise you, are reluctant to have what they view as the heavy hand of government reaching into your car. You know, we can have a debate about, of course, they do favor restrictions on abortion every year, as they are this year too, but the texting while driving thing is finally going to pass. I suspect Rick Scott will sign it, but because it's a secondary offense, it's really not going to give police that much authority.
A couple other state things here. The Sun Sentinel today with the big story on alimony changes, Rosemary, and you were talking about the letters that you get at the editorial board concerning this issue, the state alimony rules and laws, and also about internet cafes, which have now officially been banned.
Yes. There's no two issues that have generated more letters to the editor in recent months than the proposal to change permanent alimony, which is going to affect a lot of families, a lot of first wives, a lot of second wives. It says that, you know, that the old rules have changed, that alimony isn't a lifetime gravy train for those from first marriages. The letters that we've gotten are almost overwhelmingly in favor of changing the alimony laws. And in terms of families, there may be no more important issue that the legislature is dealing with. But in terms of seniors, the volume of letters we've gotten from seniors who are so upset about the closing of these penny ante arcades. And when you look in South Florida at the size of some of the casinos we've got here that are legal, and these little strip shopping center arcades, you know, are suddenly illegal, and people went there for lunch and coupons and socialization, that Florida can't find a way to make these businesses legal. Do what's necessary to make them legal, but let these seniors have their social life back.
And you're listening to the Florida Roundup. That's Rosemary Goudreau from the South Florida Sun Sentinel. Also with us again, Steve Bosquet from the Tampa Bay Times. Tim Padgett, contributor to Time Magazine. I'm Phil Latzman. We have to take a few moments here to recognize the work of good journalists, which we do, I think, on this show weekly, where we have this panel of the fine journalists. We talk about some of the best in the business, and I think that today you are hearing that. But this week was a special one at the South Florida Sun Sentinel. In fact, for two Florida newspapers, the Sentinel and the Tampa Bay Times, that won the top of their professional prizes, the Pulitzer Prize. The prestigious Journalism Award in Public Service was awarded to the Sun Sentinel for its investigation of off-duty police officers who recklessly sped through Broward County and endangered the lives of citizens. Now, we have discussed this on this show, and you remember this call to a Florida Highway Patrol dispatcher in November of 2011.
I don't know what agency it is. I'm on 91 almost to the sunrise. He's well over 120, and he's not stopping.
796, what description of the vehicle again?
All I could see was a white patrol car with blue or something like that, right? Like, it would be a Miami or DOT, and I'm sure it's not DOT.
322, if it's a patrol car, just have her back off.
Have her back off. Well, it turned out to be a Miami officer named Fausto Lopez. Turned out to be a habitual offender and speeder. He was later fired. And that got the Sun Sentinel's reporters, Sally Keston and editor John Maines, to thinking, I wonder how much this happens. And that's what led to the Pulitzer, right, Rosemary?
Absolutely. It was an extraordinary series of stories that used ingenuity, database reporting, and shoe leather reporting that documented how off-duty police officers are using their cars to speed home at 100, 120, 130 miles an hour, and they were doing it with impunity. So by using SunPass tolls records and GPS tracking devices, the reporters were able to create a database that documented what so many of us had been seeing on the roads. And the gratifying part is that people responded. You know, police chiefs would, when they saw these reporters coming and they had this stack of documents, and it's like, wow, those are all for our department. It opened their eyes to the problem they had with speeding in their departments, and they responded. There were over 163 police officers who were disciplined. People lost their cars. There were people who were fired. And the gratifying part for journalists, you know, it's not easy to be an investigative journalist. For a newspaper, it's expensive. These kinds of reporting projects take time. and an investment in money. So, you know, kudos to my bosses, Howard Saltz, the editor, and Howard Greenberg, the publisher, for putting the resources behind creating a newsroom that can do this kind of journalism. And telling people what's going on, and the best journalists, you know, that's why we get in the business, is to tell people what's going on and maybe make a difference. And in this case, we did make a difference in our community. People were happy about it. And it's an enormous honor to have won the Public Service Award.
And it's the first time that Sun Sentinel has won a Pulitzer. After,
that's right.
Like the Susan Lucci of publications.
That's right. We have a tradition of strong journalism, you know, and photography and storytelling and sports. And so a lot of it's a multi-talented newsroom.
But then again, you've also had issues like every other newspaper, and certainly we know at the Miami Herald, and every publication, Tim knows, Steve knows, I know, has had financial issues, but this is certainly something that could help. People realize that journalism counts and matters.
Exactly. And it shows what a local newspaper in a community can do to make a difference in its community. The drawdown in resources has forced newspapers to focus their efforts. And in our case, we're covering local news and we're digging into the issues that nobody else is going to dig into. And it was a proud day in our newsroom that that people appreciated the effort because the media gets such a bad rap. You know, people don't like the media except when something is wrong and they call us and they say, could you please have somebody look into this? And that's what we do.
Congratulations. Now, not to leave out Steve Bosquet, the Tampa Bay Times won the Editorial Writing Award for their campaign that helped reverse a decision to end fluoridation of the water supply. Right, Steve?
That's correct.
Congrats to you.
First of all, thank you very much. It's the ninth Pulitzer for the Times. And first of all, I want to salute the Sun Sentinel, too, a paper that, of course, I've been reading for 30 years since I came to Florida. And that South Florida, we all know, is one of the most challenging media environments in the country, for sure. And They've done solid enterprise work there for a long time. The Tampa Bay Times won the Editorial Writing Pulitzer for a crusade to return to fluoridating the Pinellas County drinking water supply, which is a proven fighter of tooth decay, but it became a huge political thing. Anyway, the editorials written by two of my colleagues, Tim Nickens, who's the editor of editorials, and editorial writer Daniel Ruth, resulted in two county commissioners who opposed fluoridation losing their seats. And I think, you know, one of the things the Pulitzer judges always look for is results. Hmm. And certainly there were results here. And it was a very proud moment for our newspaper.
Now, last week, we'll end on this note musically. Last week we heard Jay-Z's musical response to the criticism of his recent trip to Cuba, delivering another kind of response. We'll go out of music here. Miami's own Cuban-born rapper Pitbull.
Admit it if you want to. Truth is the truth. Lie if you want to. Politics, yeah, that's politics. Let's not act like half of our families ain't flip bricks. We made Miami something from nothing. Let's not forget that we came from nothing.
Now, in that song, Miami's own Pitbull riffs on Jay-Z's instrumentals, providing his own lyrics about the difficult relationship between U.S. and Cuba. You can hear it, but sort of just it's a musical story as much as anything, Tim, that we've had here.
Well, the two things I take from that song, Pitbull's song, on the one hand, like so many younger generation Cuban Americans, especially in Miami today, wants Cuba to be free, but doesn't really think the embargo's going to get that done,
right,
and doesn't really see why Washington, particularly the Cuban-American caucus there, is getting so worked up about Jay-Z and Beyoncé's trip to Havana, which turned out to be legal.
All right. Tim Padgett, he is a contributor to Time Magazine and a fine journalist. Tim, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you again for having me.
Rosemary Goudreau is editorial board editor for the Pulitzer Prize-winning South Florida Sun Sentinel. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Phil.
And Steve Bosquet is the Capital Bureau Chief of the multi-Pulitzer Award-winning Tampa Bay Times. Steve, always good to have you, too.
Thanks, Phil.
And
nice to be here.
That does it for the Florida Roundup. If you missed any of the show, we're doing it again on these airwaves tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. We also post it on our website at WLRN.org, where it's available all the time. The Florida Roundup, produced by Elaine Chen, Alicia Zuckerman, our Public Insight Network analyst, Steph Farrow, Danny Rivero, Peter J. Meritz, Dan Gretsch, thank you all, and Paul Leary as well. I'm Phil Latzman. Until next week, stay informed, South Florida.